This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week on Cadenza, we'll visit with a young group of musicians who were featured on our Tuesday noontime concert from a performance they gave in the Princeton Symphony Orchestra Chamber Music Series last December at Wolfensohn Hall at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, the Singularity Quartet. No, not another string quartet, but rather one of the adventurous new saxophone quartets on the scene. Four musicians who met while at university in Florida. They came together on the common ground of wanting to perform a particular work for sax quartet, which they did, as you're listening to them in the final minutes of a live performance from 2015 recorded at Florida State University of American composer Charles Wernon's piece simply titled Saxophone Quartet. They formed together, have now gone on to perform at Carnegie Hall, are drawing attention from noted composers, and have been hailed for their adventurous programming and 21st century approach to performance. The quartet members are Thomas Giles, Cole Belt, Scotty Phillips, and Brian McNamara. Brian's name may sound familiar to many of you, as he is also the operations manager at the Princeton Symphony Orchestra and a key part to bringing that orchestra's broadcasts to air on the Classical Network. I met up with all four members of Singularity at our station a few weeks back. I'm here today with the Singularity Quartet. You are a saxophone quartet, and still, for some people, the idea of a saxophone quartet is something new to them. They may think of four jazz players coming together and recording, but that's not the idea. This is a legitimate chamber ensemble. So when I have string quartets, as I've had many, many over the years this show's been on, I always get around to asking them how they came together and why. Usually there's common ground, so I thought we'd start there. The common ground for you guys is in Florida, and it's a teacher. So first of all, let's get how this whole thing got off the ground.
We were all in grad school together, and we all arrived in Florida. All of us at the same time were there. 2013 is when the group officially started. And we'd all been in quartets before. We'd done various things, but we had kind of a new idea. We wanted to play one specific piece. Sort of brought us together.
Yeah.
And we finally had the horsepower to do it with these specific players, and it sort of eluded each of us. We finally were able to get it together and do it.
Like, I remember the origin story, like the day that it happened. We met late August, so maybe 2 or 3 days before the semester was supposed to start. And we met for a weird late afternoon dinner thing at this amazing Thai place in Tallahassee called Masa. And we sat at that table and talked for probably 2 hours at least about everything. But I would say at least half of that conversation focused on the quartet by Charles Wernin that ended up consuming us for the next two years or so. But in that meeting, I remember being really surprised at how quickly we covered all the stuff. We came up with a name. We named ourselves Singularity, like, on the day. We had a plan for a whole program. We had a plan for, like, the direction that we wanted to push this quartet forward. I think we all individually had ideas for what we wanted from a chamber ensemble, and then it all just sort of like lined up with the rest of the people in the group.
Yeah, and I think that's why the process was expedited so much, is that we already had similar ideals in mind going into the meeting.
Yeah.
Sets you apart from the string quartets, right? Because a lot of them, they get to a string quartet, they're entering something like a competition, they don't have a name, so they actually pick it at the 10th hour. You guys actually sat down and gave it some thought beforehand. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Cole and Brian and I were actually in a quartet the year prior with another member, and unfortunately that group didn't work out quite as well. So we were lucky that Thomas was coming in, and so we're still playing together.
But there's a teacher that kind of links all of you too, right? If you want to give him some.
So the three of us were at Florida State University. Cole and I started 2012. Scotty was in 2011 in the fall, and Thomas started in 2013. We all sort of made the pilgrimage there to study with Patrick Meehan. Pat founded the saxophone program, the classical saxophone program. Actually, at the time that he founded it, it was like the jazz program too.
Yeah, he did both.
He did both. He founded that in 1974 and just retired in April 2016. So he's like more than double our lifetimes, basically, had been teaching there.
Teaching there.
And, and just this amazing, amazing musician, amazing teacher. At his retirement concert, we celebrated him for like 3 or 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And I think the common thread was that he is the kind of person that's just able to find like the best in an individual and encourage it and bring it out and help it bloom and develop, all while encouraging, you know, the proper, like, how to play the saxophone stuff. And I think that we just really wanted a group that allowed us to apply the things that he was teaching us.
Did he push the idea of forming as a quartet? I know this guy said to some of you had been in other quartets, but
he has strong opinions about quartet being important in a musician's life, chamber music being important. And of course, the most available vehicle for us is saxophone quartet, the like instrument ensemble. So did he push us? Not necessarily, but he definitely highly encouraged it.
My guest, the Singularity Saxophone Quartet, here performing music of American composer Martin Bresnik, the third movement from his work titled Everything Must Go, recorded live in concert at Florida State University back in 2015. Thank you.
you know, a string quartet has hundreds of years and decades and decades to people look back on. When you are thinking of putting a quartet, we'll get to repertoire in a second, looking to other quartets, other saxophones as mentors. I mean, on this program, we've had Prism. I've had Paul Cohen on with the New Hudson and all that. So who do you look to say, we're going to join this and be as successful as, or be just like, or be better? I mean, that's how it happens in other chamber ensembles. They sort of look to a history of it and can trace it and go from there.
Yeah, the saxophone quartet dates back to the origins of the instrument in the mid-19th century. You know, right. they're saxophone quartets from the Romantic period, and we play them. This group is a lot more focused on newer music, I would say. But in terms of models, I think we don't limit ourselves to simply looking at other saxophonists. If anything, I think we're probably most influenced by people like the Kronos Quartet or Eighth mm-hmm. Blackbird or the Jack Quartet, or you know, that sort of movement that's happened within the last 20, 30 years has been highly influential in a lot of those composers or composers that we're interested in.
Is there a sound, though, that you're going for? Because sure. that you'd have to draw from past saxophone ensembles or saxophonists.
Yeah, definitely a combo of existing ensembles and saxophonists, but we'd be totally remiss to not mention the Rauscher Saxophone Quartet.
Of course.
Founded in 1969 mm-hmm. here in the States, and then they moved to Europe
Germany.
Full-time yeah. in the early 80s, I believe. And that group, founded by Sigurd Rauscher, was just a tremendous force.
The pioneer.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an amazing career. And
Sigurd Rauscher was also a teacher of Padmians as well.
Right, so there's the lineage. So that sort of approach to the saxophone informs us very much, and the approach to chamber music specifically that the Rauscher Quartet has. But also, I mean, we listen a lot to a lot of groups. We've spent a lot of time with a lot of the Prism Quartet recordings, especially when we talk about maybe some of the other pieces, the Martin Bresnik, Everything Must Go. I remember the first time we listened to that, we were in a hotel room at a competition, we were looking for more rep because we didn't win the competition, so we were kind of bummed and we wanted to change. So we're looking at rep, and we find this piece, this recording. I had never heard the recording. I don't know about you guys.
No, I hadn't.
But the movement is supposed to be in just intonation, which is totally foreign to our
second ears. Movement. Second movement.
Yeah. And we heard it for the first time, and we're just totally blown away. So, I mean, I'd say that we really try to gather influences from a lot of places.
Well, I want to go to rep. I know what you're playing today, and we want to talk about, you have like three sample programs on your website, all which are very fascinating. But just when you formed the group, okay, you had the Wern and saying, we're going to try to do this. But then there is the realization past that is, that's not a complete evening of a concert. So immediately you have to start thinking of, where is repertoire going to come from? And you mentioned, you know, Thomas, you mentioned various models here. You have Kronos and people like that, Eighth Blackbird. But initially, when you're first getting off, I mean, is it just everybody's tossing in, listening for stuff? Or did you have a group of pieces maybe you brought from the other groups to say, here's how we're going to start building the repertoire before you start going out and getting?
Well, I think just like many young chamber groups, we thought about the competition circuit a lot. And so that in and of itself made us think about a variety of programming. So we sort of took an interest in some Renaissance music, which I mean, you'll see on this program. We also played Debussy String Quartet in G minor.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful arrangement for saxophone quartet. And I think we grew just as much from playing that music as we did from playing the Wernen.
If not more.
It's a real kick in the pants to play string music, you know, because it's so non-idiomatic. It forces you to be light, forces you to explore textures that maybe most saxophone quartets don't. There's just a certain ease that you have to...
Yeah, it requires a lot more transparency
Absolutely.
Than what a lot of the other saxophone quartet rep requires, because a lot of it's scored a little bit more thickly, and with the string quartet rep, you really have to get the thin, clear textures.
Right. Well, the three programs you have on your site, just the sample programs, it's like really kind of show the range you guys do cover. The first one's called Original Masterworks. You can talk about that. Genesis of Inspiration, and then String Theory, and that goes to what you're just saying, and it goes beyond the Debussy, stealing from the string quartet repertoire to perform on saxophone quartet. Some older music arranged for saxophone quartet by my guests today, the Singularity Saxophone Quartet.
This setting of the Ave Maria by the Flemish Renaissance master Josquin des Prez.
Thank you.
Talk about all three of those, whether it's new works. Where are you at on commissioning? Or
well, we'll be doing one premiere on this tour, and that, it's interesting, is an intersection with the string quartet idea. We were talking, this is a new development, this is the first time we're trying it, but this concept of doing a double alto quartet, where the traditional saxophone quartet is baritone, tenor, alto, and then soprano going up, and exchanging the soprano for another alto, and it darkens the overall timbre of the group, and it gives it a really nice blend, because the soprano is the only straight instrument, and that is said to sort of influence the timbre a little bit, make it a little bit more crackly. They do make curved sopranos, but it's a little bit difficult to get a rounder sound, and we find that this combination of double alto really is something special and unique and something we want to explore. So we commissioned a piece for that, and we've actually changed the way we sit to reflect the string quartet too. So where we have the viola, the tenor on the outside, and then the two altos, if you're looking at the stage, on the left, and then the baritone in the back, where the cello would be. And that's been really interesting to explore. We're also playing this work by Tristan Kuras, which is very, very wonderful storied quartet in our repertoire, with this arrangement, this imagination of two altos, originally scored for soprano on top. It's really interesting to hear how it's turning out.
The thing with the masterworks and those sorts of things, we do try to inform the way that we play original saxophone rep with what we hear in string quartets, especially. I guess we're talking like as much about a string quartet as we are about a saxophone quartet, but there's a lot of influence there, and I think a very conscious effort to bring those sorts of sonic worlds and like playing styles to what we do, because the saxophone, it's really pretty easy to sound like a chainsaw on it if you're not sort of controlling it, and I think that that's the thing that we really try to bring out in the programming.
Yeah, and just in regards to the programs, talking about each section of them, the original masterworks, believe it or not, there is quite a large canon of original works for that ensemble, and a lot of them we have the Rasha Quartet to thank for, including the Kuras and the Warnin, and so they just don't get played very often, quite frankly. They're just hard. And it's largely because, yeah, they're very challenging, very difficult, and no other group was really doing something like these works as they're being written. So that's something we're passionate about, is making sure that those get out there and those are heard more often. And then, as was mentioned before, with the string transcriptions as well, we are forced into doing things that we wouldn't ever normally have to do on the instrument to make it sound the way it needs to sound, or at least the way we think it should sound.
Well, the middle one here, this the genesis of inspiration, takes works, again, not written for saxophone, which are transcribed or arranged for sample, and then asking a composer to use that as a starting point. That's what I gather from this. The two composers here were Josquin des Prez, the great Flemish Renaissance composer of masses for the most part in chanson, and then also Georges Ligeti. So
that was our program for the Carnegie concert that we may end up talking about at some point, but that actually wasn't a demand we made on composers to do so. It was just sort of something we ended up finding out about how we programmed.
Lucky.
All the music on that program had already existed before we had programmed it. How that one came about, we liked the Josquin microludes, and we wanted to pair it with the original chanson to kind of create the context for the piece. Then we wanted to play the Breznik, Everything Must Go, because we were so floored by that. And
we found that Ligeti was his teacher. He studied with Ligeti.
Yeah.
And there's a movement that's in memoriam to him.
And so we thought the Bagatellen would be a good way to kind of pair the teacher inspiring the student.
In the Ligeti, there's a movement entitled In Memoriam Béla Bartók.
Béla Bartók, yeah.
Another layer back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then if you jump, the third one, the string one, you mentioned the Debussy, but on this one is Haydn, Schumann, probably hitting the Schumann sooner than a lot of young string quartets. Then Vasques, Petrus Vasques. How do you pick which string quartets fit? There are certain musical considerations here, I would assume. And then also, how far can you take that, or are you going to continue that?
I think that's what we're really discovering. How do we pick them? I think they kind of pick us, or they pick the instrument. We can't play double stops. You know, we're limited to four notes, so they really have to be movements that are pieces or movements that don't super emphasize that difference in instrument. But as far as just the free counterpoint and the range, the saxophone has an incredibly wide range that isn't as maybe as well known to people that aren't in the know about the instrument. Each instrument has about four octaves on it. And so you really cover the same range as the string quartet with the saxophone quartet. And aside from those stylistic or idiomatic differences, a lot of what has been written for string quartet can automatically be transferred.
Well, I remember, Thomas, you were really enamored and are still with the quartet by Vosk.
Yeah.
I think you told us that you used to like listen to it at night before you go to sleep when you were in school. Yeah. And David, to answer your question, I think about picking these pieces, it's sort of like we just hear a thing and fall in love with it.
Yeah.
And get kind of imaginative and maybe a little more bold than we you know can execute right up front. But it's one of those things that I guess it makes it sound like it's an academic exercise, and I don't know that it always is, but it's certainly that exploration of our individual and collective capability is definitely an element that plays in. But it's basically just like we like playing these, or we like listening to these pieces, and then we just want to try and play them ourselves. It reminds me a lot of, you had the Public Quartet in recently, sort of their approach to Bach and like reimagining a lot of what those things were. I know that they play the opening movement of one of the sonatas for solo violin, but they reimagine it in a way that spreads it out throughout the whole quartet. And they're kind of taking it one step further than we're going. We're pretty literal translations to our instruments, but it's that same sort of just imaginative process. Like, how can we emulate a string quartet, but more importantly and ultimately convey the messages in this piece that we're hearing.
I haven't noticed a lot of saxophone quartets doing this, though, going into the string quartet repertoire. So this is kind of, you know, some people might see it as blasphemous or whatever, but I mean, you know, the fact that you're doing it is interesting. That's why I'm wondering how far you can take it.
Yeah, sure, it's a little bit risky, and, you know, we're very aware that some people might be a little hesitant at first, but
sometimes we're hesitant too.
Well, yeah, but stop reading my mind. We've actually had a lot of success taking string orchestra and actually full orchestra music and grouping it for large saxophone ensemble. You put like 10 or 11 saxophonists in the room, soprano all the way down to like the 5-foot bass saxophone. Right. At Florida State, the last 2 years, we did Schoenberg's Verklärtenacht for saxophone ensemble and took it to Lubbock, Texas for the big saxophone conference in March. And the performance was a great success. Brian didn't play on that performance because he was up here, but the three of us did. And we learned so much from that. And it was just one of the highlight musical experiences that I've had so far, and I'm sure for the other guys, yeah.
Well, and Scotty, you're not just playing the pieces, you're also sort of, like, I know in Singularity, we were, like, just messing around the other day talking about, like, what our job titles would be. I'm sort of, the quartet mom, I think, and Scotty's, like, the staff arranger, but there's a huge element when we're playing string music, either in quartet or in a larger ensemble, we're not reading the score strictly. Right. Scotty's adapting this stuff generally for us, so thanks, Scotty. But there's some imagination that goes into that, and I think you must be making some decisions like off the bat, you know, up front, and demands on us. And you also know like what we can and can't do. We try not to like bring the can't do into the equation. But so you kind of play a large role in that too.
Sure.
Some music my guests performed at their concert at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton back in December, music of the now artist-in-residence at the IAS, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang, the second of his revolutionary etudes, the Singularity Saxophone Quartet perform. Thank you.
Princeton concert, you're playing a piece by David Lang. These really accomplished composers, talk about Wernin, but I don't know if this makes a difference, but they're not saxophone players. I'm just wondering about pieces that have been written for saxophone quartet composers you'll be approaching or working with, whatever, but they're not players. I know the saxophone's not a difficult instrument to write for. It's not like writing for harp or something like that, where you really got to figure things out. But still, I'm just wondering about that approach to getting pieces that you're playing by non-saxophone performers.
Yeah, I mean, we're strangely lucky with that. The saxophone, you mentioned the harp, and you took the words right out of my mouth. You know, we don't have the issue that maybe a guitar or a harp would have.
Right.
It's pretty intuitive. If you can think it, you can pretty much make it happen. You know, maybe one of the blessings of having it be invented later is that it's conceived with the idea to be able to play chromatically and now semi-chromatically. You know, we have probably the greatest access to quarter tones that any acoustic instrument has that's not maybe specifically designed to do that. Like, all that kind of stuff is just, it's a real treat to not have to work so hard that you would on another instrument.
Cole, do you want to talk about Neil's piece and how all that happened, the new piece we're playing?
Yeah, so I wanted to say, in some cases, it's kind of a blessing to have non-saxophonists write pieces, because as we've always talked about, we often just tell the composer, write a piece and we'll figure out how to play it. It's not like we'll play anything just because you're writing for us. It's that we want it to be boundless. And when I approached Neil Anderson Himmelsbach, who is the composer of the piece that will be premiering shortly, and the one that Thomas was talking about that begins to experiment with writing for a double alto quartet,
right.
That's exactly what I told him. I just said, hey, we want something, just write boundlessly, and we'll figure out how to do it. We've got this range, and this is what you can do, so go for it. And he really did. I mean, the stuff that is happening with the double altos, with the range that he's got us fluidly going through, it hasn't really been done before, which is why.
So how high is that? Like, I mean, we're talking range, but it's, I mean, you guys are playing up where, like, at the top of, like, a good flute player's range, maybe. Like, an undergrad
sometimes
flute player is sort of, yeah. So, like, that's kind of how high we're getting here, is quite high. It's like, I mean, sort of dog whistle-y, but pretty.
He's got the alto one at the top of the fourth octave. It's pretty much the peak of the range, and then he's got me the second alto, fourth below that, and we're moving fluidly together through that range. Mm-hmm.
Tell him to do the two alto, or did he came up with that?
We did, yeah.
Okay, so he
originally thought soprano, and then I said, well, actually, we're experimenting with this. Are you open to that? And he said, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So last thing on rep. And you're talking about saxophonists playing music for saxophone. The saxophone is so identified with other styles and genres of music. Obviously jazz, but also pop music and R&B and all this kind of stuff. There is a lot of music out there in the jazz idiom for saxophone ensembles. As you build your rep, as you build these programs, knowing that your audience, some of your audience is seeing a saxophone quartet play this type of music for the first time, yet they have this other sound or this other style in their head. Are you going to incorporate pieces that come right out of the jazz style or something like that in your repertoire? I mean, do you want to have that range to cross over? Thinking about what string quartets are doing these days, like with the public quartet, they're cross from classical into jazz, right? You have an instrument that is highly associated with a jazz idiom. What's your thoughts on that as a saxophone quartet?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to be pigeonholed into that mold, you know, thinking of the saxophone as a jazz instrument rather than an instrument that can play jazz.
Right.
There are groups that specialize in just playing jazz, like the World Saxophone Quartet and so many others that do that so well. We're classically trained musicians, no different than any other orchestral tradition. It wouldn't probably be putting our best foot forward to do that. It's not what we specialize in. But also, I think it's interesting. You always try to find a way to set yourself apart as an artistic vehicle. It's still somewhat infrequent to see a saxophone quartet that just specializes in playing classical music. So, you know, if you have a string quartet that's known for playing Mozart and Haydn, and then they go on stage and they do a little hoedown, you know, that's the exception to the rule. And we have the exact opposite, you know, where we're expected to do that. And it's interesting to go out and play an all Bach concert, you know, to play an all string quartet concert. So that division is probably a little bit more interesting to us to make that distinction.
I mean, like, I'm just too, speaking for myself, I'm too square to play jazz. Like, I we can do it. And I think I can, like, maybe imitate it if I've, like, had enough coffee that day or something. But it's just a thing that doesn't come naturally to me. And I think what it is for us is that, at least, I don't mean to speak for the rest of the group, but I know personally, like, maybe this sounds psychotic to say, but like the music of Charles Wernon really like moves me and speaks to me. Yeah. And I think that that's why, you know, to go back to that fateful dinner meeting at Massa in Tallahassee, like we all just sat down and said, we want to play the Wernon Quartet. And it was almost like at the same time. And what that is, it's just like coming from inside. Like that's just what we love. That's what we've always loved listening to. Part of the Princeton program focuses on, Cole, on your reaction to The Curious, like as a young lad and, you know, budding saxophonist. And I think it's like what we can't help but play, you know? And it just so happened that we just don't really do jazz. Right. That said, in Neil's piece, I'm like playing a funk bass line at least 90% of the piece. And it's really fun and it's really great. It's just not a thing that I think any of us are as familiar with.
That piece is entitled Circles and Grooves, and it comes a lot from Neil's history with playing bass for Ben Folds and other groups that he's played for, but and, you know, being a composer. So he wrote it, the title, pretty literally. We're circling and grooving.
Sure. So.
Once again, dipping into that concert my guests, the Singularity Saxophone Quartet, gave at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in December, which we broadcast this past Tuesday, here are the opening minutes from the Dutch composer Tristan Kurys's Music for Saxophones.
Cole, you name-dropped this small venue in New York called Carnegie Hall. I'm just wondering about high points so far, your young group, and then, you know, flip it over. What's the plans for the next years? Do you stay together? Is that the plan right now? And if so, what are you looking forward to? But talk about some high points right around where the group is now.
Carnegie Hall obviously was a pretty big high point for us.
Fun, yeah.
I mean, I think it turned out to be a bigger success than any of us anticipated. There was a lot of work going into it. It was part of a Sight and Sound in Motion competition that was is basically like writing a grant proposal in a way through FSU. And we took that on. We wrote that proposal. It took a lot more time and effort than we thought, but we also kind of plunged into a rabbit hole with it.
Also got the proposal in like 35 seconds before the deadline.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
And it started to develop on its own very organically, I think. Yeah. And it was because of that, I think, that we enjoyed it so much and we had some success with it too.
Yeah, it really started with the program, right? Like we had the Genesis of Inspiration program is what we played in Carnegie. So the two Juskan pieces paired with the piece by David Ludwig that's influenced by Juskan. The two sort of historically inspired pieces, one by Zdeněk Lukáš, a rondo that draws a lot on Lukáš's experiences in the Prague Spring after the invasion by the Soviet Union, and an elegy by Greg Wanamaker, who's a composer up at SUNY Potsdam and professor up there. And that was written as Greg's response to September 11th. And we, of course, thought that that was sort of an appropriate thing to play in New York. The second half of the program was the Ligeti piece paired with Bresnik. So educational influence, teacher, student influence. And then the Wernin closed out the program. It was sort of our mic drop moment. And that just inspired us, you know, so that's
a friendship.
Yeah. I mean, I remember at that concert, maybe sometimes like in my like very young performing career, I don't know about you guys, but like in huge moments like that, it's sometimes a bit of a blur. Like it just kind of, it's over before you know it. But
Personally,
I was really present for a lot of it. Yeah. I remember like crying a couple times on stage. And, like, it was really weird. But it's just, it also like, maybe the quartet like never felt better, you know, up to that point. But we had had some other stuff. We did the Festival of New Music things too in 2015.
That's how we met David Lang.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Now we're playing his wonderful quartet.
Yeah.
And that's been a lot of fun to explore.
Yeah.
And much like any high point that happens, it's a lot about what leads up to it that makes it so special too. So it was the fact that we were forced into putting our ideas and ideals onto paper. It was about developing that program, about reaching out to these composers, Ludwig, Bresnik, and Wernin, who all ended up showing up to the concert as well.
And Greg Wanamaker.
Thank you. And it was about the fact that we scheduled a tour in our, you know, geographic region of Tallahassee, Florida area beforehand to prepare us and to make it feel like going into Carnegie was another concert that we had to play. So I think that's what allowed us to be present on stage.
So what about going forward? I mean, does a group like this, you're going to do this for a while? Or is it, I mean...
We have no plans to stop.
No plans to stop.
Yeah.
Well, that being said, then what is to come? What in short range here? What do you need to get accomplished as a group?
Well, I think geographical location can help. So Brian's up here. I'm up here. I just moved to Brooklyn in June. I think Cole will be coming up here in 6 months or so.
As soon as I finish the doctorate. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Tristan Kyrus, he's writing a full-length dissertation on Tristan Kyrus's works for the saxophone. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that special piece too.
And I'm earning my frequent flyer miles from Orlando.
Yeah, so we got two in Florida and two up here.
Soon to be three up here.
Yeah.
I think the geographic location is the thing that we talk about maybe more than any of us anticipated at first. I mean, this quartet just really, it really truly did start in that restaurant. And then just kind of things just keep happening and we just kind of roll with it. But something that we realized maybe I was the first to finish up at Florida. I finished my master's. Actually, the Carnegie concert was the last official Florida State thing that I did, which is a great way to go out of school. Like that. Can't beat it. But at a certain point, I think maybe in my last semester there, we realized that we needed to maybe start like putting some brainstorms together, some concrete ideas. I had read a book during my arts administration degree that talked a lot about using art and collaborative relationships in a community to build communities. And so we just talked about like being in the same place. So like from a logistics standpoint, it's great if Scotty doesn't have to fly and Cole doesn't have to fly. But it's also a thing that we just think can really benefit us, you know, to be together, but also maybe like the community that we're in and a part of.
I think, a friendly neighborhood saxophone quartet.
Yeah. You know, like we just, you know, maybe like play at the soup kitchen as much as we play at, you know, National Sawdust, hopefully someday, maybe fingers crossed. I think that that's one of the things that informs us. So we're really kind of keen to work with composers that fit that ideal, work with other groups that are into a sort of collaborative community model. we have like our wish list, our like wish dream list of composers that we want to commission and do all of that. I think we're all sort of practicing our grant writing chops and everything like that. But outside of that, I mean, we're just kind of trying to come up with programs that maybe respond or reflect, you know, how we're feeling collectively, but also things that might be pretty relatable. You know, we talk a lot about some of the foreign elements of a contemporary classical saxophone quartet, and that's something we're very conscious of. I think we try to program things and want to continue trying to program things that people can just like relate to on a kind of a fundamental level.
Yeah, I think what you're doing and how you're approaching it, from what our listeners have heard, if you look at other groups, even established ensembles like string quartets, that's kind of their mindset too. And this is kind of the 21st century mindset of making this more a connective thing, not just bound to stage at set auditorium, you know, recordings. And that model is kind of blown out of the water anyway. Well, I wish you great success going forward. Hope we hear a lot more from you in many different ways. I'm sure there'll be recordings coming out where they come out some way as downloads or however they come out. There'll be ways for people can hear you who can't get to any of the venues you play at or tour. So congratulations so far, and keep it going.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Singularity Saxophone Quartet, Thomas Giles, Cole Belt, Scotty Phillips, and Brian McNamara. You can find out more about them at their website, singularityquartet.com. Another program note, we broadcast the Singularity's Princeton Symphony Orchestra Chamber Music Concert this past Tuesday. Tomorrow, our noontime concert will broadcast another of the PSO's Chamber Series, this featuring the young and adventurous string quartet, the Public Quartet. I'll leave you with another of my guests' performances recorded live at Florida State University back in 2015. The fourth movement from American composer and Georgia native Michael Broder's Musica Derivata. This movement titled Unforced Errors, performed by my guests today, the Singularity Saxophone Quartet. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.